Okay, so thank you for coming this morning. And as John mentioned, I manage Harvard's Means Matter campaign, which aims to increase the implementation of suicide prevention strategies that incorporate lethal means restriction. And one such strategy that I've worked extensively on over the past couple of years is the New Hampshire, what we call the New Hampshire Gun Shop Project, which is going to be the focus of my presentation today. And I would like to acknowledge my coworkers, Kathy Barber at Harvard and Elaine Frank at Dartmouth and Elaine DeMello at NAMI New Hampshire for their great work on this as well. Before I delve into the Gun Shop Project, I do have a couple of slides, oops, that are hopefully going to arise here. Yeah. Maybe not. Okay, it doesn't like this thing. Means restriction, just a little background on means restriction. So traditionally, suicide prevention has focused on who takes their life and when and where and especially why. And we're beginning to understand that how people attempt suicide also plays a crucial role in whether they live or die. So why is that? Why is it crucial? First of all, over half of the deaths in the U.S. By suicide each year are firearm suicides. And according to a review by an international expert panel in 2005, reducing access to lethal means of suicide is one of only two intervention types that currently has evidence of effectiveness in preventing suicide, the other being physician education in depression recognition and treatment. So many different studies of different types across the U.S. have found that the presence of a gun in the home is a risk factor for suicide, and other countries that have reduced access to their most common means of suicide have seen huge reductions in the suicide rate. And citations for all of this are available on meansmatter.org, and I can also give them to you afterwards if you're interested. So how exactly does means restriction work? It works in a variety of manners. One is by reducing the lethality of attempts. Nearly any other method by which you could make a suicide attempt has a better odds of survival or a lower case fatality rate than firearms do. Secondly, the acute phase of a suicidal crisis is often brief. So in 2002, there was a review of, I think, about 90 studies that found collectively that 90% or more of attempters did not go on to die by suicide. Even serious attempters that were hospitalized for, say, jumping in front of a subway, and even when they were followed for a decade or more, 20 to 25% did go on to make another attempt, but that was non-fatal. So this indicates that if it were possible to increase the odds of surviving the initial attempt, the odds of long-term survival are very good. Attempts often involve little deliberation. There was one study showing that 24% of those who nearly died in a suicide attempt made that attempt less than 5 minutes after saying to themselves, I'm going to commit suicide. And another half of them had the time that passed between I'm going to kill myself and making the attempt was less than an hour. And 13% said that it was only 13% or more said that more than a day passed. So basically, if a highly lethal acceptable method is unavailable, the odds are increased that either a less lethal method will be substituted and then chance of survival increases, or that the attempt will be delayed, in which case the suicidal impulse may pass. So given all this, what are some of the barriers to implementing means restriction strategies? We at Harvard worked on interviews. Well, I did a lot of these interviews with suicide prevention state coordinators about 6 years ago, and we looked at their the state plans on suicide prevention. So the national plan does call for working on lethal means restriction, as did 84% of state plans at that time. And most suicide prevention coordinators we spoke with did believe that a gun in the home increases the risk for suicide. However, and again, this is about 6 years ago, only 9 states were actively working on a lethal means reduction strategy at that time, and most of the rest of the states cited the political contentiousness of the gun issue as a barrier to working on guns in their as a suicide prevention strategy in their state. They felt that this was a non-starter as a topic, and it was not going to be an effective strategy for them in terms of funding or in terms of engagement of the community and so on. Outside the suicide prevention field, there are also assumptions about intent that I think make the conversation difficult when you're in the suicide prevention field trying to do work in the community. There's a lot of, if you really want to kill yourself, you can always find a way. If the gun isn't there, you can get in your car and drive it into a pole. And this sort of mentality also, I think, is a challenge to working on means restriction. So this project, the Gunshot Project, presents an opportunity to have a non-politicized conversation with gun owners about guns and suicides. And it follows a peer education model in which gun owners are talking to other gun owners about guns and suicide. And the goal here is to change social norms around storage and access of guns by someone suicidal, rather than to enact any sort of legislative approach involving firearms. This involves collaboration with gun shops, sports clubs, and other gun rights groups in the state of New Hampshire. And as I mentioned, it's not a legislative approach. So the background for this project is in April 2009, there were three unrelated incidences in the same week in the same store, which was the largest retailer of firearms in New Hampshire, where someone purchased a gun and then killed themselves within a few hours or days afterwards. So an ad hoc committee was formed to look at 2 years' worth of state suicide data in New Hampshire to see whether this was an anomaly, and we found that basically 1 in 10, 8% of firearm suicides in New Hampshire were with recently purchased guns, and this is probably an underestimate because in two-thirds of the incidences we didn't know when the gun was purchased. So we basically adopted a twofold mission. One was to educate gun shop owners about steps to avoid making a sale to someone who may be suicidal, and that would therefore hopefully have an impact on the recent purchased firearm suicides. And secondly, we wanted to use this as an opportunity to talk with customers about making their firearms inaccessible if a family member is in crisis, which would in turn address the much larger number of suicides involving an existing household gun. So, to pursue this, our little committee got adopted by what was then the dormant New Hampshire Firearm Safety Coalition, and that brought in other retailers and firearm safety instructors, activists on pro-gun rights issues in New Hampshire, pro-gun state legislators, and other public health and mental health professionals in New Hampshire. We gathered information on current dealer practices, just anecdotally within the group, and then through a survey I'll get into momentarily. We talked about means restriction research, so everyone was sort of on the same page within the coalition about efficacy of means restriction. And we drafted materials for both dealers and customers, and I'll talk about those in a minute also. Then we launched the survey that I just mentioned with gun shop owners to basically develop some sort of baseline data and get feedback on our draft materials to figure out how to proceed with the development of our project. So in the baseline survey, I managed to interview half of the retail establishments, firearm retail establishments in New Hampshire. So that was about 30 shops out of, is this the right side I'm going to be on? Yes. And so we basically found that, I think I want to be on the next slide, yes. Okay, 97% of the shops didn't have any written guidelines for staff regarding the sale of a firearm to someone suicidal. 78% didn't have any sort of handouts on firearm safety that they made generally available within their shop. But over 80% said that they would display or share draft materials that we were showing them. And 84% were receptive to learning more about this issue. So overall, these were good conversations, and dealers seemed open to the idea of having a discussion about suicide and providing materials for customers and for their staff, if they had staff, on this issue. They gave good advice on draft materials. Where the results were a little more mixed was in their beliefs on means restriction. So you'll see what I mean about this when I show you their responses to three baseline questions that we asked in talking with them. So the first was a question basically about impulsivity, which said, do you agree or disagree with the statement, the vast majority of people who kill themselves planned it weeks ahead of time? 44% agreed with this, a third had no idea, and 22% disagreed with this statement. So a lot of belief that this is something people are contemplating for a long time, and not, in other words, believing that there's an impulsive element to suicide. Then we asked two questions about a hypothetical scenario involving a suicidal teen, and his name was Jeff. So we said a young man named Jeff lives at home with his family. His family's worried that he's suicidal, so they take all the guns in their house temporarily and transfer them to a home of a friend living elsewhere. Do you think that doing this makes Jeff safer, less safe, or it makes no difference either way? And they were divided as to whether Jeff was safer or it made no difference. Almost no one said that it made him less safe. Then we said, okay, so Jeff attempts suicide. The guns aren't at home, so he substitutes another means, such as pills or hanging. Do you think he's more likely, less likely, or just as likely to actually die using some other method as if he had used a gun? This was a really hard question for them to answer, and because we didn't have additional questions or to try to get at this concept, it is a limitation that we don't know how much of it was difficulty understanding the concept versus the cognitive dissonance around saying, oh, you know, if there was another method, maybe they would still be alive. But 75% of them said he is, you know, at the end of the deliberations on this question, said that he's as likely to die as, you know, whether it's a gun or not. So then the packets that we mailed out ultimately included a variety of things for dealers themselves and for their customers. And I don't have time, unfortunately, to go into all of them. But the major elements were a tip sheet for dealers that went through, here are some signs that someone could be suicidal. Here are ways of handling the situation as it arises. Remember that just because somebody passes the background check doesn't mean you're required to make a sale. And then a couple of items for customers. One was a brochure that predominantly included standard language that is already used in the firearm safety community about safety, or the firearm community about safety, but it featured sort of an 11th commandment as we worded it, which was about suicide. And it said, consider temporary offsite storage if a family member may be suicidal. When an emotional crisis or a major change in someone's behavior is causing concern, storing guns outside the home for a while may save a life. Friends, as well as police and shooting clubs and so on, may be able to store them for you until the situation improves. The second thing that was geared towards customers was a poster that basically said, concerned about a family member or friend, hold on to their guns. And it provided a couple of quick bits of information about suicide, such as suicide in New Hampshire far outnumbers homicide, guns are the leading method, and attempts with a gun are more deadly than attempts with other methods. Some signs that someone may be suicidal and information on who to contact. The project was received quite well, we were pleased to say, that we got some favorable media coverage both in the state and in a national magazine, Combat Handguns. An esteemed journalist in the gun community wrote a great 4-page article on the project. These outlets also donated ad space for the poster. Additional brochures, we were contacted for additional brochures from some retailers, so we gained some new coalition members. It wasn't all rosy. There was one gun blog that accused the project of being anti-gun, but this didn't seem, it seemed to be basically a fringe group as far as the distribution of gun rights groups in New Hampshire goes, so that wasn't a death knell for the project. And there were stories from dealers of their own experiences with this issue and being thanked later for denying a sale to somebody who was going through a crisis at the time. And again, most shops beforehand and afterwards when we did our evaluation were willing to discuss the project, so we were able to learn from them about their experiences. So in doing an evaluation, we wanted to first figure out how many dealers were using the materials and what materials they liked best. So both to improve the response rate and to make sure that dealers weren't telling us what we wanted to hear, we visited unannounced. And then secondly, for dealers that didn't have our products out, we wanted to know why and see if it was something about the materials or the coalition or the concept. And so we particularly wanted to know whether belief in lethal means restriction was necessary for project participation, because there was certainly, it was not uniform within the coalition that this was a linchpin for which people would participate or not participate in the project. There were some that had the view within the coalition that what brought them to the table was reducing firearm suicide, not necessarily suicide overall. They were more concerned about the image of guns and how it's sort of bad for guns when a gun is used in suicide. And so they didn't think that the lethal means was important to getting project participation. So in driving around to all the shops to see whether or not these things were up, and we did visit some shops multiple times, so this number would not be what it is if it wasn't for repeat visits, but we did find that half of these shops had at least one product on display. This was a 6-month evaluation period in the first half of 2012. A third of them had two or three things on display that we created. The most popular item was the brochure, 43%, and about a third also had a Lifeline card that we gave out, a wallet card from the National Suicide Lifeline group. And then about a fifth had the poster out, and I put a little asterisk by that because the way that the poster was sort of inserted into the packet seemed to result in a lot of people not seeing the poster. And so it was a new thing for a fair decent amount of stores when we came by to see if they had it. And, you know, a lot of them did go and put it right up. And, you know, in some cases we were able to go back and see, oh, it's still up, you know, like a month later. And so we're a little unsure about how to perceive that number. There were two stores that mentioned receiving negative customer feedback. Oh, I had the materials up and I took them down because somebody complained. I should have put an asterisk by this because I went to both of those stores and doing the baseline surveys, and they detested the project from the get-go. So it's a little hard for me to believe that they put any of the materials out. But this is what they told me. There was no collective change in belief in lethal means restriction from the baseline to the evaluation. When you look at it, sort of line it up store by store for individual level change, there were, you know, a handful that didn't seem to indicate belief in lethal means restriction that now did, but there were a handful that went the other direction. So, you know, collectively there was no change. However, those who had a product in use were more likely to be younger dealers rather than older, 67% of those under 45 versus 45% of those older, but it was hard to get any finding that was significant when you're talking about 60 dealers. But what we did find that was significant in spite of that was belief in lethal means restrictions. So 67% of those who did believe in this concept at the point of evaluation had products out versus 41% of those who did not. And then when we asked about barriers to putting out these materials, or to endorsement of the project, when we were talking with those shops who didn't have anything out, again, the most common reason given for not using materials was belief that gun access is not related to suicide, and that, you know, if the gun isn't there, they're going to find some way to kill themselves. Other common reasons that were given included sort of not believing that this was their role or their place. You know, I'm not a psychiatrist. It's somebody else's job to ascertain whether this person is suicidal. And then just lack of comfort with the idea of discussing suicide in general, and, you know, not wanting to make their customers uncomfortable and feeling that this could be bad for business. I realized that I should have made a slide on the limitations, and I did refer to one or two of them along the way, but one definite limitation is that we didn't ask the exact same question about lethal means restriction in what I'm calling the baseline and the evaluation. And that was sort of a concession made in doing community-based participatory research. Some people felt like it was kind of patronizing, you know, to ask the dealers the exact same question, you know, 6 months later. And so we're attempting to measure this concept without using the exact same questions before and after. And then also it wasn't possible to get information from every store. We did talk to almost every store. I think we talked to maybe 66 out of 69 stores. But the other thing that changes a lot and is a limitation is the denominator of stores. This is a list published monthly by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, but stores come and go, and the list includes hundreds and hundreds of people who are dealing out of their private residences or not dealing at all and just possess a federal firearm license. So just trying to keep on top of how many stores there are and is very difficult. And, you know, we can't be sure we got to every single store or identified every single retailer in New Hampshire. So next steps for the project include approaching chain stores about how they sell firearms. There were plenty of dealers who said, you know, I know what I'm doing, and I would never sell a gun to someone in X, Y, or Z circumstance, but you got to go talk to Walmart. And, you know, this kind of provides some foundation for us to have that conversation, we hope. And we also want to disseminate the materials to other stakeholders, including police and health professionals. And there's going to be some need to tailor the materials for them, as well as in sort of pursuing an ongoing relationship with the dealers in New Hampshire. We're going to redesign the poster to sort of address some concerns that people brought up who chose not to display it and had seen it. Then we're working also with presenting these findings to other states and providing technical assistance to several other states that are seeking to undertake the project. And if any of your states are interested, please come up and introduce yourselves. And then we want to research ways to address liability concerns. A couple of dealers said that they were worried about getting sued if they declined to make a sale to somebody, you know, and they were, you know, using their own opinion to determine whether or not this person was a suicide risk. And, you know, a couple of dealers said, you know, I'm not comfortable making this decision, but, you know, if there were information in the background check system, you know, mental health data basically available through that system that says, you know, oh, this person was in a mental hospital, hospital for a month, you know, a year ago, then they'd be fine if it was somebody else's call not to, to make the sale. With the liability concern issue, one way of trying to address this is it turns out the largest insurer of all of these stores insures most of the stores in the Northeast, and if we could possibly have a conversation with them about providing incentives for their shops to put up our materials, like a, some sort of discount for displaying our materials and so on, then that would be one way to sort of boost confidence in the dealers and their participation. So I know I'm getting close to running out of my time, but our conclusions are that gun owners are definitely important allies in suicide prevention. I can easily say that in my decade at the Injury Center, this has been my favorite project, and it's just been really fascinating to work with the gun community and the contributions back and forth in terms of ideas and leadership and how to pursue the conversation have been really excellent at the sort of cross-pollination of ideas between the public health, mental health community and the gun community. There's some notion that subtle messaging is important, you know, that people were hesitant to talk about suicide or put materials about suicide up in their stores, and, you know, the brochure may be a sort of ticket in there because most of the information is about a different topic. And then the movement from thought to action, you know, with all these barriers aside, was substantial. So we were pleased to see half the stores being involved in the project. And it does seem that belief in lethal means restriction is a key component of that. So that's all my stuff. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. I'll just say it is 10 o'clock, but there is a half hour till the next sessions are scheduled to begin. So we'll take a few questions, but if you feel you need to leave, you can quietly leave. That's fine.
Steve.
It's a great project. It's a great work.
Thanks.
I think that framing to the gun sellers could be further leveraged by saying that there are significant percentage of suicides that are murder suicides that affect others, including children, other family members, and in the case of Milwaukee, it involved others that are pursuing their daily lives and occupation.
Right.
So do you think that that can further leverage their sense of community while also addressing the very narrow approach that you took today, that broadening it to something might also broaden the participation?
I do think that's an important notion to think about and to certainly include in the conversation we're having with dealers. The incident that comes to mind immediately when you bring this up is a conversation I had with a dealer who did not choose to participate in the project, and his experience with this issue basically consisted of selling a gun to someone who went in the to his car and shot himself and died in the parking lot of his shop. And there was a note in the car or other evidence in the car that indicated his plan originally was to take the gun and go kill his coworkers. And so he basically had the philosophy that, you know, you have a right to kill yourself, and it's a good thing this guy killed himself. And so there's definitely stories that come at this from all different angles that have to be incorporated. Yeah.
It seems like there's a distinction in the advice that you were giving between not selling guns to people who are at risk of killing themselves versus informing people who buy guns and gun owners who go to stores about how to care for their guns and family.
Yes. Yes.
That's, and it would seem to me that the former case is much more difficult one to make gun salespeople than the latter case.
Yes. Absolutely. You know, it's a much smaller percent of suicides, and this is the part where dealers felt like, you're asking me to be a psychiatrist, I don't have the training to do this. One response to that was a lot of the I wish I had a copy of the tip sheet with me, but I think I have a picture of it in my slides. A lot of the signs that we were sort of presenting were also relevant if you were trying to reduce your chances, say, of making a straw purchase, a sale to somebody who is not who is buying a gun on behalf of someone who is a prohibited buyer. So, you know, that somebody comes in your shop and doesn't ask any questions about guns. They just say, I want a gun, and you say, what would you like it for? And they say, I don't care, you know, just get, you know, any handgun will do. A lot of the, and so that was one way of sort of getting around this was, you know, if you're doing X, Y, and Z, you know, just as sort of general good practice on gun sales, then you will help reduce your odds of making a sale to somebody suicidal. But yes, a lot of the dialogue did focus on this latter issue of, you know, well, what about the notion that people coming in your shop, you know, are living with people who may be going through a hard time, and, you know, how about having materials available for them? And that was something that was a lot easier for more dealers to embrace. Yeah.
Did you address the issue of gun laws and gun safety, or did you
For your second question, I would definitely say whatever the most common means of suicide is in that country. So, you know, again, I didn't have time to go into examples, but there are at least three I can immediately think of in other countries of successful lethal means reduction strategies. One was in Sri Lanka with pesticides. They were very composed of very highly toxic chemicals, and when they changed the composition of the toxicity, the composition of the pesticides, the suicide rate plummeted. I don't know if anybody here remembers the rate offhand, but it was like a 50% decrease in suicides. And there was a similar story out of the UK when they changed from coal gas to different gas for their stoves. The suicide rate plummeted. And then the third example was Israel, and they're in the military, and their gun access, where they stopped allowing military to take guns home with them when they left the base during the week, and suicides plummeted, and it was all suicides during the week that were happening when they took their guns off base. So what was your first question? Gun locks and safety. Yeah, the brochure definitely said, you know, in addition to encouraging off-site storage, we recognized that some people were not going to do that and did say, you know, or store your guns locked and unloaded and so on. We asked a bunch of questions about storage with the dealers, but it seemed like dealers were a little iffy on offering storage themselves, number one, in terms of space and, again, liability concerns if, you know, oh, we're going to have a fight later when there's a scratch on the gun and who caused the scratch. But it also seemed that people in general were more comfortable if they're going to trust their beloved gun with somebody else, it being a friend or a brother, you know, not necessarily going, in spite of the fact that most people have good relationships, it seems, with their local gun shop, they had other resources before they would turn it over to sort of a more public facility. Yeah. Thank you. Oh, great. Yes. So my colleague Matt Miller has been doing some work with the DOD on reducing military firearm suicides, and so I'd have to point you to him to find out more about how that is playing out exactly, but yes, there are efforts to work on lethal means reduction within the military community. Yeah?
I'm just curious, what kind of tool did you provide the store owner to attempt to identify, you know, somebody that was at risk for suicide?
So here's the first half. I couldn't get the whole thing and have it be at all legible of the tip sheet that we gave to dealers. So basically, as I said, most of these are also usable if you're just trying to prohibit a sale to a buyer who's not authorized. If someone comes in and doesn't have any knowledge about guns whatsoever, and they don't really seem interested in learning, like certainly you could be a first-time firearm buyer, but it seemed... 90 to 95% of the dealers that I spoke with want to really have a conversation with their client about what it is that they want the gun for, just to help them make the appropriate sale. So when a customer doesn't want to have that conversation, that's a big red flag to dealers. When they're not seeming responsive to you, the dealer's questions about this purchase, when the responses that they're giving are unconvincing as far as what they intend to use the gun for, when they don't have any interest in firearm safety or maintenance, if obviously, these are sort of more obvious signs. If they mention a recent crisis, such as a divorce or job loss, some other setback, if they make other comments, you know, even sort of jokingly, that could suggest suicidality, like, oh, I don't need a lot of ammunition, I'm not going to have this long, you know, or something. They seem, you know, their body language is disconcerting in some way, you know, in terms of poor eye contact, looking anxious, so on. And there were, you know, cases that dealers told me about where customers just seemed distraught the more that you talked with them about what it is that they were buying the gun for. One dealer told me this heartbreaking story of this elderly woman who came in to buy a handgun, and she'd said that she wanted it for defense, and so he helped her pick out a gun, and then they got down to the ammunition question, and, you know, he said, how much do you want? And she said, you know, I just need one bullet. And, you know, he said, well, you know, I'm sorry, I can't sell you this gun. And, you know, she broke down, and, you know, her husband had recently died, and, you know, he called the police. And, you know, so, I mean, imagine if this had been a dealer who just didn't ask any questions and said, okay, here's your gun. You know, then that what's not sort of showing on here is the options for responding, you know, should this sort of situation arise, you know, if you're an employee, notifying your manager, talking with the police, I'm trying to remember all the other ones that were on here now, but just trying to help them have this conversation with the customer, or, you know, a lot of dealers, we asked them, have you been in this situation, how have you handled it, when we did the baseline survey, and most of them hadn't been in this situation, but of those who, for whatever reason, maybe not necessarily suicide, felt uncomfortable making a sale, if they didn't feel comfortable kind of directly addressing why with their customer, they'd just lie and say, the background check, this is stuck, or it's not going through, come back next week and we'll see what happens, you know, and a lot of people didn't come back next week, or, you know, they seemed to have more security about making the sale or how the interaction with the customer went after some more time passed or what have you. So, you know, we'll take it, whatever strategy they're comfortable using to sort of keep going. Yeah. Right.
And cutting people off.
It yes.
Really has been kind of philosophy. So it's great to see the supply of suicide. I'm from Chicago, and it is almost unimaginable that this could work in the state of Illinois. It's so polarized.
Yeah.
Between the city of Chicago and the state.
Yeah.
Every few months, we have a knockdown, drag out fight about concealed carry in the state legislature, and they've been able to push it back. The issue in Illinois is more homicide than suicide.
Yeah. So another thing I didn't have time to build into the presentation itself was how do you build a coalition like this to do a project like this in your state? And it's absolutely essential that, you know, as I sort of mentioned in my introduction to the project, that this is a gun owner to gun owner model. So the first thing you need is to identify who your likely supporters are to take this on as their own initiative. The coalition in New Hampshire was co-chaired by this woman, Elaine Frank from Dartmouth, who was the suicide prevention expert, you know, as far as the two chairs. And then the other was the vice president of the state NRA chapter. And he happened to be the one who owned the largest retail shop in New Hampshire. So he was highly respected in the gun owning community in New Hampshire. He was the one where these three incidents happened in 1 week, and he was, you know, very concerned when this happened. You know, I mean, we could have wound up with a dealer who hung up on us when we called up and said, oh, did you know that there were these three incidences from your store? But we were lucky in that sense. Certainly, you know, even if you don't have an analogous situation to sort of introduce the issue to someone influential in the gun community in your state, it may take more effort, but you should be able to find other people who would be receptive to this model and feel that this is a good strategy. And, you know, again, talk with us. I mean, if there's any way that, you know, Ralph, who's our co-chair, you know, has connections in other states that would be helpful, you know, we're certainly happy to do anything we can to help launch it in other states. But it is absolutely important before you really do anything to sort of have informal conversations and take kind of the pulse of the gun community in your state. The national NRA has been absent on the issue. And even the state NRA, honestly, we kind of were hoping to get their stamp of approval on the materials, and we didn't. You know, he presented the idea to their board, and they were like, you know, we're not going to take a position on this one way or the other. So we would like to go back and do a presentation to them and see if we can, you know, officially get them on board. That would clearly get the attention of the federal NRA, which is not necessarily something we want. But so far, we've managed to build up a lot of support without getting, you know, these official stamps of approval. Steve.
Yeah, I can't overemphasize the approach that NRA's taking. When we started looking at the pilot data that eventually led to the National Violent Theft Reporting System, we had members of the NRA on our community, our group, calling for better information. They were partners. And so this strategy of partnering with credible, in this case, gun dealers who want to do the right thing, want to be advancing community health and so forth, while being a business, I can't overemphasize this approach and how it does advance it. The NRA's original purpose for being in 1871 was for safety. Mm-hmm. And when you remind them about that, a lot of the political stuff, it goes aside. And you get advancing, you get an advancement in this, which I think is really important, that could be then a model for other states. So I think a great example of how important this approach is.
suicide is along registered gun owners versus guns that are on the streets. And obviously, in certain areas, guns that are on the streets are going to be used more in the population. So I was wondering if you knew what the rate is of suicide among registered gun owners versus guns that are on the streets.
Huh. Okay. So I think the best data that we have, I'm just kind of thinking nationally at the moment, and we just know, we've done studies at Harvard kind of looking at states where their gun ownership is high versus states where gun ownership is low, and have found that if you sort of group states, you know, kind of rank them according to high gun ownership and low gun ownership, and then match them in terms of population, so you're looking at a similar amount of people in high gun states and low gun states, what's the suicide rate between those two groups? You find that the suicide rate is infinitely higher in, not infinitely, but it's much higher in the states where there is high gun ownership than states where there is low gun ownership. You don't know that those guns are guns that existed in the home versus being, you know, illegally sold on the streets and so forth. But there are other studies showing that, you know, a gun in the home is a risk factor for suicide. And so I feel like there's sort of a collection of evidence showing that that where guns are more present, you know, it's typically guns in the home that are then being used for suicide. I don't know as much about guns and suicide on the streets, sort of illegal gun sales. I don't know if anyone else here can weigh in on that. But does that help answer your question? Okay. Yeah.
I don't think that matters that much. Frankly, the suspicion really broad in public health professionals. The overall community level of guns in the community, regardless of whether it be legal or not, I mean, that could be a feature. There are numerous ecological studies that have looked at levels of gun ownership. I don't know if they're illicit or not, showing that that's highly correlated, not necessarily with a higher rate, but with the likelihood of using a gun to increase suicide.
Right. It does matter in the sense of thinking about prevention strategies,
but that's true, but we need to lower the level, 300 million guns or whatever it is, to come down.
Right.
That was a weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah.
And we need to address that issue. And, you know, I think we're beginning to compromise on this issue and, you know, narrow the focus of the means restriction efforts. And that's a little bit troubling to me.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
When it comes to reach and when it comes to youth of color, they're more likely to use a gun that on the street than a gun that probably has their own.
But we have elderly men aged, say, 80 and over, 80%, 90% of these men, those have guns that are on the street.
No, I'm talking about different populations. So I'm talking about
right, and I don't know a lot about the suicide rate for, say, you know, men under 30 in urban areas who might be more exposed to the prevalence of illegal guns trafficked in their community. But, Steve?
I guess to get to Alex's point of the gender differences, so males versus females for firearms, was there any background evidence that you found that suggested that those females didn't have a gun at the time because of why or Z circumstances, and that the men did commonly have a gun as part of their death-ridden status or whatever?
Not in that particular study, but two things that might relate to that is, again, because we couldn't distinguish active duty versus veterans. Mm. Now, studies that have looked at females' active duty in terms of method show that they use firearms almost the same as males in terms of a percentage. So at least that's saying something about that environment of being on active duty and the use of firearms. So it may be that we ended up, you know, in our population for our study with a lot of female veterans as opposed to female active duty.
And that they may not hold on to their guns
whereas
the male veterans.
Right, after they get out, you know, they get rid of it or they turn it back in or something like that. So that may be an issue to relate to. One other thing that might sort of relate to the question that you asked is, and again, it's ecological, but when we saw homicide go up at an increasing rate in the United States, late 80s, early 90s, that a lot was associated with influx of firearms into the inner city, especially having to do with crack cocaine and other stuff, we also saw suicide rates among African-American males. It's higher than African-American females, but it's not as high as some of the other groups. We saw those suicide rates start to go up too. And we think that a lot of that had to do with the flow of firearms into those communities that homicide rates really went up, but suicide rates were going up too. So, and again, you know, whether those are, probably a lot of them were illegal firearms, but you know, it may also point to, I think, what Mark was talking about, just you've got the prevalence of firearms, you know, everybody got one, or you know, it's in every home, that it may increase the rates of impulsive.